Oh, there's a lot of news happening all around the world and right here at home. Producer Tom, push that button.
What's trending on the campaign trail?
So poor Jay Inslee had the opportunity to introduce himself to the 112 people who watched CNN and their town halls last night, and he botched it so badly. So badly. He is a candidate who is singularly running on the topic of making our environment great again. See what I did there? You see what I did there? That was like MAGA, but with the environment. And yet when he was asked a question about recycling and the crisis of recycling, because we have a whole big issue right now all across the country, all across the world, of China saying no more to accepting recyclables, we've got a problem. Tacoma has got a significant issue right now dealing with this. But Jay Inslee pays no attention to what's going on here because of this delusion that he's going to be president one day. He couldn't answer a basic question about recycling.
Recently, several foreign countries have stopped purchasing our recyclable plastic waste, which means that a lot of what we're putting in recycling bins now never actually gets to the point of being recycled. How can we fix our broken recycling system?
Maureen, you know, I thought I had the answers to every question, but I do not have an answer to that. But next time we meet, I'm going to have a better approach.
There's not going to be a next time that you meet, Governor. This is a basic question, a very basic question. For you to say you don't have an answer is just bad politicking. It's awful politicking. It shows you're in over your head. All you had to do was say, we should invest in the infrastructure, creating jobs, by the way, in the infrastructure, so that we can handle recycling in the United States. Done. Talk about green economy. Throw out some buzzwords. Never say, I don't know. Why would anyone vote for someone like you who can't answer a basic question? A basic question. Having to do with your singular issue. Now, there was a whole host of different topics that they got on past global climate change and the environment. He told an audience member, for example, that the filibuster rule in the Senate has to go.
I'm a primary care physician. Many of my patients who have survived life-threatening illness have subsequently experienced medical bankruptcy, some even having to move to a homeless shelter due to exorbitantly high medical bills.
Just by the way, I don't believe that she knows anybody who had to move into a homeless shelter. And if you did, you should be shamed. What a bad friend. Why don't you have them sleep in your home? Sleep on the couch.
On review of your public option plan for Washington State, It is unclear how this crisis can be prevented. How would you reform our healthcare system to prevent medical bankruptcy?
By the way, I do like the bite in that question. I looked up your stuff online, and it's just really vague, and I don't understand it.
Well, as you noted in our state, Laura, we are going to be hopefully the first state to have a public option. And it's one step forward, which would provide the state to provide a mechanism to get insurance for those who don't have access to the private markets or Medicaid. And I'm very hopeful that this can be an example for the rest of the country. And I do think there is a little bit of a refrain tonight, because I do believe my state can be a template for a lot of things, including health care. But that won't be the end of it. We will have to expand federal health care dramatically. Uh-huh. I believe we should lower the age for Medicare. I believe we should allow people to buy into Medicare so you can have Medicare for people who want it right now.
I wonder, does he at any point talk about how he's going to pay for any of this? Or is it just like, tax the rich? Tax more people.
It's negative.
Yeah.
I think we should explore potentially enrolling, you know, new folks into healthcare when they're born. So there is much more
new folks when they're born. Okay.
To be done in the healthcare realm. But I will share this with you. We are not going to be able to get healthcare done, or anything else for that matter, unless we get rid of the filibuster. And I was the first candidate in this race running for president to be very unequivocal about this. If the filibuster is still in Mitch McConnell's hand come 2021, all hope is sort of down the tubes to be able to do
drain
real significant reform. So I'm telling you, if I'm given this high honor, I will lead the charge to end this senatorial privilege, which is an ancient artifact of a bygone time.
Era.
And let's get some health care reform and climate change legislation and reform the United States of America. That's what I'm pledging to.
I do like how he had to shoehorn in the environmental stuff at the end there. it's always funny when people talk about getting rid of the filibuster, because many mainstream politicians on both sides of the aisle, they all take the exact same position of, yeah, that's not a good idea. It's only a good idea until you're not in the majority, which is why you shouldn't do it. It kind of follows the same thinking that of a quote that I usually give on the show. Imagine the power to censor in the hands of your worst enemy, meaning, hey, it feels really good right now for you to censor the other side because you've got all the power. But what about when you don't? The same issue applies to the filibuster. Getting rid of the filibuster is awful. It's awful because it's going to be abused by one particular party when they're in the majority. And then when they're no longer in the majority, they'll go ahead and they'll continue to complain. Oh, we should have never had, we got a return of the filibuster. That's generally how it goes. It's a bad idea. Then they got into the whole idea of, I'm going to pardon people who are wrongfully locked up, which is not really important. Okay, good for you. But then he gets into marijuana and he talks about how it should be legal at a federal level because communities of color are affected. He wants so badly to be that woke old white dude. And it just doesn't work for him, but he tries.
And it is my belief that it's time for the United States to decriminalize and legalize marijuana. I believe that very, very firmly.
To be fair, by the way, that is a very green position. Nothing. Nothing, Tom. Not even a ha-ha. Nothing. Not even an acknowledgement that that was a good joke. Nothing. Like, not even a frown of like, well, you should have tried again. It's not funny. Just nothing. Just silence and a blank look on your face.
I didn't actually hear it.
You're the worst.
Now, this is just part of our effort to right some of the injustice in our judicial system, too. Because the drug war has been one of the elements of such racial disparities in our judicial system.
He supported that war at some point in his past.
And we need to bring justice back into the justice system. That's one of the reasons I was the first governor to offer pardons to over 3,000 people with marijuana convictions.
Wow.
Because the drug war has resulted in too much racial disparity. So I hope we get the whole country to follow Washington's lead. But I think that sounds like a theme. Follow Washington's lead. Look west for success. I kind of like that. Governor.
Oh, my God. I wish he'd stop reminding people he's from Washington. I saw this tweet from an organization called Act Now on Climate. This is that super PAC. I believe it's a super PAC that's spending a lot of money on behalf of Jay Inslee. They decided to buy in to his campaign, even though they're supposedly not being authorized by any candidate or candidates committee, even though they're working on their behalf. They're just doing it without any coordination, so they say. I just saw a tweet that they posted. And I think it's the best tweet I've ever seen. I think, in fact, it might earn an award. Because it is so utterly dishonest. It's so transparent in what it's trying to do. It's shocking. This is the tweet. Jay Inslee is surging. His performance during the CNN town hall showed that he is the leader we need to combat climate change. Join the campaign. He went into yesterday's town hall with 0%. There has not been a poll that has been done since last night's live town hall. To suggest Jay Inslee is surging is just utter dishonesty. Utter dishonesty. He's not surging. He's doing the opposite of that. That's been his campaign the entire time. And last night he put on display just how incompetent he is. He is a one-trick pony who screwed up one answer, the easiest question of the night on recycling. He's going nowhere. He is not surging. He's getting worse. And I didn't think that that was possible. He botched the only opportunity he's going to have on a national stage for 1 hour of softballs. He botched that. You have to be spectacularly bad to get this so wrong. We'll see where the ratings are for CNN. Kristen Gillibrand, who did the town hall the day before, had the lowest ratings of any town hall. Let's see if Inslee can at least win that race. Because if anyone can win the race of who's the most unpopular, I at least think Jay Inslee could win. If you're listening to The Jason Rand Show, 1-800-465-8770 if you want to join the conversation on the None Better Tax Resolution Hotline. 1-800-465-8770. Don't forget, we are all over social media. Hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or on Instagram. You can find us there. Right now, let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending at home?
So I want to give credit where credit's due, because when activists go out there and they take on an issue that's really important to them and they actually succeed, I believe strongly that we should give them kudos. So kudos to the Seattle activists who fought for rapists and murderers to gain access to books on erotica and horror stories. Kudos to them. Because that's kind of hard. I didn't know that rapists and child molesters and murderers, I didn't realize they had such fans in the activist community, but apparently they did. You see, last week we brought you the story of the Department of Corrections here in Washington. They decided to quietly change a policy that stopped accepting donated books from nonprofit organizations. They would still get books to give to prisoners. They would get it through the state library. But activists got upset that a local group called Books to Prisoners got cut off. And so they started to speak out. They put pressure on the DOC. The DOC decided, oh, okay, never mind, we're going to reverse our policy. And so now Books to Prisoners gets to continue to donate books to anyone based on request. That's the thing. You can just write in and say, hey, I would like some erotica. Could you please send over some fan fiction for Harry Potter? The erotica version. They can call for that, assuming there's a book that's like that. I find this problematic. You see, I would have no problem whatsoever if this was a conversation about connecting prisoners who want to get their lives back on track with books that will actually help them once they're out of prison. GED preparation books, for example, which is something that actually that Books to Prisoners does. But you know what they also give out? True crime, graphic novels, erotica, something called urban fiction. I'm not entirely sure I know what that is. And they don't make a difference. They don't see a difference, apparently, between the rapist and the person who is a nonviolent offender. They treat everyone equally. So I'm not going to give them a pass. This organization is doing good work, despite the fact that, yeah, they do some good work. But they also do some bad work, because I'm not in a position where I feel bad that a rapist doesn't have access to the erotica book of his or her choice. Sorry, call me insensitive, as many people on Twitter did today. Because after it was tweeted out, my story, my blog, a whole bunch of people from the Progressive Blue Checkmark group, they got all mad, insufferably mad. Prisoners are human too. Stop dehumanizing prisoners. I'm not dehumanizing prisoners. I just don't want to make it easy for rapists to get books about erotica. I don't want to reward them. I don't care that they don't have access to erotica fiction. I honestly don't care. And this whole idea of dehumanizing them, let's be clear about something. They're the ones who dehumanize. They chose to rape someone. That's dehumanizing. They chose to murder someone. That's dehumanizing. Not giving them a true crime novel? That's not dehumanizing. That's part of the punishment that you should serve when you're convicted of doing a horrible, horrible, horrible thing that changed the lives of so many people. But again, congratulations, Seattle activists. You did some good work. Good for you. If you want to read my story, want to help me shine a spotlight on this, text the keyword RANTZ, R-A-N-T-Z, to the number 1-800-465-8770. Text the keyword RANTZ, R-A-N-T-Z, to 1-800-465-8770. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? National.
So it was a little bit shocking this morning to find out that Julian Assange of WikiLeaks was abruptly booted from the Ecuadorian embassy in London. They revoked his asylum and invited in the London Metropolitan Police, who very quickly arrested Assange on our behalf. Our behalf, United States' behalf. because he's going to be extradited here. He faces charges of conspiracy to hack a classified Defense Department computer. He is a hacker. I know that some folks on the left want to pretend that he's some whistleblower, but he's not. He's a cyber terrorist. There was a fun conversation this morning on The View between Meghan McCain, who, good for her, she's really standing up for conservative principles there, and Sunny Hostin, who's just insufferably bad. And she just reads notes from the Obama administration pretending that, oh, well, the Obama administration, they said this was protected speech, so I guess it is.
Propaganda, just so we're clear.
If the law is propaganda, I'm sorry.
They're not First Amendment. He was a cyber terrorist from day one, which is how we got in the situation we're in right now. You released 750,000 classified or sensitive information that put our military at risk, that put our spies at risk, that put our diplomats at risk. And I'm sorry, but Democrats only started caring once it started implicating Hillary Clinton.
That's 100% true. You'll recall before the DNC hacks that exposed the corruption on behalf of the Hillary Clinton campaign, you'll recall that there were a lot of progressives who were saying Julian Assange, Bradley Manning at the time, big heroes. Oh, they're such heroes. They outed torture. They outed what was going on under the Bush administration. Edward Snowden, oh man, you are such a hero. But then they turned on WikiLeaks because WikiLeaks was responsible in large part to a boost to the Trump campaign. And now all of a sudden you've got some Democrats who are saying, oh, we got to go after Julian Assange. Now, to be fair, there are some Democrats like Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, who's been pretty consistent on this, and he's not changing his tune. He's happy to see Julian Assange come back here, get extradited here. So hopefully he can do some prison time.
And I think it's very good for us to finally get him on U.S. soil so we can investigate, we can basically cross-examine, we can find out the facts that only he knows and his connections and how he basically distributed his information. This is something that they can extract from Julian Assange. I think it'd be great for the American people. It'd be great for us as lawmakers, making sure that we protect the system, John. And the system is basically how do we protect against foreign invasion type.
Remember what he did. He released national security details. He put out classified information. He put out personal information on spies and diplomats that put them at risk. Understand that. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? You can't make this up.
This is my favorite story of the day, I think. A federal grand jury just brought 36-count indictment against Michael Avenatti, the creepy porn lawyer, as Tucker Carlson of Fox News says. He's been charged with embezzlement, fraud, perjury, and more. The LA Times reported the charges stem from his dealings with a whole bunch of clients, including Jeffrey Johnson. Jeffrey Johnson is mentally ill and paraplegic. He won a $4 million settlement from LA County. But apparently, the claim is Avenatti hid the money from the guy for years. He also allegedly hid $2.75 million from another client. The day after he received that money, he allegedly purchased a $2.5 million private jet for a company he owned. Oh, here's a fun fact, courtesy of the Daily Wire. The jet has since been seized by federal agents. So this, on top of the 47 years in prison that he might face for separate charges, those charges come from New York. That's the whole extortion thing with Nike. He could see 355 years in prison. Now, as much as I don't like Michael Avenatti, 300, that's insane. We're not monsters. We should should bring it down to 255. 350, that's, wait, right? I mean, 355, this is the United States of America. Let's at least be fair. It should be 255 years. Remember when he was the future candidate from the Democratic Party for president? Quick poll, and you can text us at 1-800-465-8770. Right now, who has a better shot at getting the nomination? Michael Avenatti or Jay Inslee? Right now, if you had to pick right now, who would get it? 1-800-465-8770. 1-800-465-8770. Send us your text messages. Jason Rancho on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. Brian Moran is the new U.S. attorney for the Western District of Washington. He's based here in Seattle, and he's caused a lot of waves within progressive circles for saying heroin injection sites are categorically illegal, and you probably shouldn't do them in Seattle. U.S. Attorney Brian Moran joins me now. Sir, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Jason. Happy to be here.
Have you been shocked by some of the responses to your earlier interviews on this topic?
You know, I guess I wouldn't say shocked. I've been kind of overwhelmed with citizens reaching out to me. I didn't see that coming, and it's kind of affirming. You know, obviously, I make my decisions based on the law, not on any particular constituency in Seattle or outside of Seattle. But I've had a number of folks reach out to me and thank me for taking a position.
Well, what's interesting is nothing you said is controversial at all.
I don't see so under the law. You know, that's, I mean, there are lots of studies. There are lots of people urging me to study the issue. And I need to be abundantly clear. I'm the U.S. attorney, and the studying that I do relates to the code of the United States code, and that United States code is pretty clear that maintaining an injection house, or however you want to term it, safe injection house, consumption site, it's patently illegal under federal law. So that's my resource. That's where I go to read and research these things, and that's what the U.S. attorney is supposed to do.
So from your perspective, obviously, there are some city leaders who say, essentially, they're going to move forward anyway, and if you have to get involved, you'll get involved, and they'll fight that. I'm presuming that they expect that they'll get maybe an activist court that might say this is a new innovative way to treat heroin addiction, and they'll allow it. But, I mean, realistically, is that even a viable option for courts if they're legitimately looking at the law?
You know, that's, look, the courts are bound by the same law that I am, you know, and I don't know whether the city leaders will move forward or not. I hope they take pause. I hope they take my position seriously and think it through, you know, but if they do pursue it and we bring some sort of action, and I'm not going to commit to what that action might look like at this time, there are a host of actions. But look, I mean, at some point, some district court judge may have to look at this, and he or she will look at the same law that I'm looking at. And I want to be clear, we're all trying to find a solution to the horrors of 64,000 of our fellow citizens dying every year in this country because of methamphetamine, opioid, and overdose of any type. But, you know, that law doesn't allow an exception for good intentions, and it doesn't allow an exception for a city doing it as opposed to a charitable organization. So, you know, I have seen not just cities, I've seen counties, I've seen individuals try to push the envelope, but I'm pretty confident in what the law says, what the law means, and pretty confident in how a court is going to view it.
So I believe it was KOW that indicated you had a conversation with the Seattle City Attorney Pete Holmes on this. Was this a proactive conversation? Did you bring this up? How exactly did the topic of heroin injection sites even come up?
You know, it was, I have to think back, but I believe, so first of all, Pete Holmes reached out to me, as did many members of the law enforcement community, city attorney's offices in my first few weeks in office. I did the same. I reached out to a number of law enforcement officials. But he asked to meet with me. I said, absolutely, happy to meet with you. He came in. He had a list of issues that he wanted to talk about, and he specifically asked me about safe injection sites, and I told him exactly how I viewed it, how I viewed the law, more importantly, and what I was prepared to do. I suggested to him that he just not go there. I did tell him, I understand you're a lawyer and you have clients. I've been in the AG's office. I was a lawyer. I had clients. And, you know, ultimately the clients get to make those calls. You know, the lawyer's not a potted plant necessarily, but the lawyer gives, you know, his or her best advice. And sometimes clients take it, sometimes they don't. I just suggested to him that he communicate to his clients that this was a no-go for me.
Well, what's interesting about this is one of his clients is a mayor who used to be in your position. What do you make of that? Is this one of those things where it's just now it's political versus legal?
You know, I don't, you know, I honestly don't know where the mayor comes down on this issue. I mean, she may be in favor of it. She may not be. I haven't talked to her about it. I've met with her. I've talked about a number of other issues. This was not one of them. So, you know, I'll leave those questions for her to answer. you know, I will say in my experience dealing with the mayor, she's an excellent lawyer. She knows the law. I'll leave it at that. But it's just not a topic that I've discussed with her. And
sure.
It's interesting because you have a former U.S. attorney who has a lawyer. So it was kind of like when I was in the attorney general's office and the governor was Chris Gregoire and she asked me for legal advice. It was always an interesting mm-hmm. position when you're a lawyer taking legal advice. So I'll leave that between Mr. Holmes and the mayor.
Just joining me, Brian Moran is on the line. He's the new U.S. attorney for the Western District of Washington State. We're talking about heroin injection sites. And I'm curious, you indicated that you're not going to say exactly what you would do, what action would be taken by the federal government against heroin injection sites. But are you taking the position that you won't sit back and not do anything?
Yeah, I mean, if an injection site is stood up, it comes to my attention, which I have to believe it would. It's not like you can run these things secretly. The neighborhood's going to know about it. Action will be swift and sure and decisive. I haven't mulled over the range of those options. They range from criminal penalties that are available, theoretically, to civil injunctions and forfeitures. So I'm not going to commit now to what my range of options would be, but I certainly would take into account, I think, as any U.S. attorney would and any prosecutor would, the intentions and motivations behind it. If some other enterprise were to stand up a drug house and it was mm-hmm. totally unrelated, then my reaction to that might be different. So all tools available to me are on the table, but I would always take into account the motivations, the intent, as you would in any case.
How much of your conversation on this is being driven by guidance coming from the Trump administration? Obviously, last year we've seen some significant word coming from the White House, coming from the Department of Justice, saying that this is not okay. They're going after it in Philadelphia. Is this something that's an active conversation between you and D.C., or is this just a general, because we're talking about it here, you're now talking about it?
Yeah, no, I would say that it hasn't been a topic of conversation. Generally, there are 93 U.S. attorneys around the country, he or she is left pretty much a broad range of discretion authority. Every district's different. Look, I mean, state of Washington, Eastern and Western District is different than Oklahoma, and Oklahoma is different than Louisiana, and Louisiana is different than Vermont. So we have a wide range of discussion. I am aware of the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, the action they took to enjoin it, civilly enjoin it, seek a declaratory judgment action. But no, this isn't a topic of conversation, at least now, with Maine Department of Justice.
So I want to switch gears slightly, although I think it's related. You're saying you're going to go after heroin injection sites, which is a position that I 100% support.
Mm-hmm.
But what about marijuana? We're a state that has decided to legalize marijuana, yet the sale and use of marijuana is federally prohibited. Is there any fear that you're going to go after marijuana dispensaries or marijuana businesses?
You know, that's a really good question, because it does appear that I'm taking inconsistent positions. But so let me backdrop this thought process. One, legal marijuana under state law violates the Federal Controlled Substances Act. I've been a prosecutor and in the prosecutor circles for most of my career, and that spans about 30 years. I've never seen a time or an issue where something was obviously legal under state law, patently illegal under federal law. So this is a brave new world in terms of marijuana. The reality with marijuana is, one, there was a vote, and a vast majority of Washingtonians, as in several other states, decided they wanted to try this experiment and legalize it. I'm acutely aware of that. But I don't really operate just on, public popularity. The other reality here, though, Jason, is that I've got about 60 prosecutors, or criminal prosecutors, and this is a very big district. It's 25,000 square miles, 25 tribes, numerous military installations, major national parks, major drug trafficking organizations. And the reality is, even if I wanted to, I just couldn't. So I've made the decision that the federal government's prosecution resources in this district are not well spent going after legal marijuana. The voters voted, destroying neighborhoods. And because it's sort of accepted legally, I just want to make sure the state doesn't take an eye off the illegal marijuana market.
So it sounds like you're saying the main difference, at least for you, is the vote, right? That people had an opportunity. And, of course, when it comes to heroin injection sites, we were told by the courts we don't get a say in that. We wouldn't be able to vote, at least the way that it was initially done. So that's good to hear, because on the one hand, I'm with you with heroin injection sites. They're not safe, which is why they have people who are there supervising. But I wouldn't be with you if you went after medical marijuana. It should be a state's rights issue. And I guess my last question for you is, would anything change if there was, in fact, a vote on heroin injection sites, whether it's in Seattle or King County, wherever it is, and the voters said yes, it still would be against the law federally? Would you then look to this topic the same way you would look to marijuana?
I don't want to commit myself one way or the other. I think a lot of it's that, I'm not subject to the whims of votes necessarily. Yeah. I mean, look, prosecutors and police are not good policymakers. We're good policy implementers. I would look to the federal law, guidance from other districts, and I don't want to comment on facts that aren't before me. I'd take a hard look at it. I'm aware of the initiative. I'm aware of what the Supreme Court said about it. That really didn't factor into me. At some point, and I think this is the point I want to make, is even with legal marijuana, you just have to draw a line somewhere. So if it's patently illegal under the legal marijuana regime, we don't allow drive-thrus, and somebody stood up a drive-thru, that's something that's going to get my attention. I really don't want to predict what I might or might not do or what the voters might or might not do. But ultimately, my policy guidance comes from the United States Criminal Code.
I think that's very fair. Ryan Moran is the new U.S. attorney for the Western District of Washington. Thank you so much for stopping by this afternoon. I really do appreciate it.
My pleasure, Jason. You have a good day.
You as well. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text message. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show, live in the Online Trading Academy studio. Senator Guy Palumbo, the Democrat from Maltby, he wanted a school levy bill to fund charter schools, not just public schools. Unfortunately, it didn't go so well for him. It earned him a censure from the state Democratic Party. State Senator Guy Palumbo joins me now. Guy, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me, Jason. And I'm sorry I cheated on you with Saul Spady last week.
I know. We got to keep you loyal, but you're a Democrat. What can I say? So congratulations. You got censured. Take us through what happened.
Yeah, so we've got, and I got to apologize in advance to your listeners. We're literally on the floor right now voting on bills. So I may have to run over and do a voice vote. So I apologize if I get interrupted very briefly. It was kind of a big deal for us, is that we had this levy bill. I put on an amendment to basically make parity between local levies, between charter schools, public charter schools, and regular public schools. And unfortunately, I got censured by the party as a result of it.
How did you find out about the censure?
So I was in Ways and Means yesterday or the day before, and a lobbyist came up to me and just said, hey, you got censured by the party. I didn't know about it. Hold on one second. I got to stand on the floor here for a vote. I called the party chair and found out that, in fact, I was censured. So didn't know about it ahead of time, didn't know about it afterwards. That's what happened.
So what does it mean when the state party censures you?
Basically, at their conference, which was in Pasco, I guess, last week, about 50 or so people are part of this committee, and they pass a resolution that basically says I'm a bad person, and, that's about it. I mean, that's essentially the censure, a little written statement that says you're a bad person.
Okay. So, and by the way, Guy, I've always known that about you. You're a horrible person because you're a reasonable politician, and that makes you bad to the Democratic Party. Why is it that Democrats are so threatened when anyone stands up and says, hey, charter schools and charter students, they should also get some consideration from the state?
Yeah, it's really hard because if you think I ran in 2012 and lost, and charter schools was something that was a big issue in that race. I kind of got excommunicated from the party on it. At that point in time. There's a lot of people that just don't want to have alternative methods that may or may not hire union teachers, which I understand. But, you know, even President Obama was for charters. You know, there's, you know, equity groups are for charters. You know, mostly these charters serve disadvantaged kids, kids of low income, kids of color, and disproportionately special education. And they just provide one little tool in the toolbox for certain people that need something different than the traditional public school model. But for some reason, a lot of people just can't let go because, you know, we passed Initiative 1240 in 2012, and then there was multiple lawsuits from the teachers union mm-hmm. that went to the state Supreme Court. And that last lawsuit finally ended this past fall. So, you know, they're here. They're legal. The people have voted on them and approved them, and the Supreme Court ratified them. So, I mean, at some point, people need to move on. You know, and basically, I'm concerned about the low-income kid at a charter school. Like right now, they don't get local levy money. So that's anywhere from $1,900 to $4,200 less per pupil at a charter school, and you cross the street to another school, and they get that extra money. And to me, that's not fair, just because people don't like charter schools. Like, we shouldn't penalize the low-income kid, you know, in his life or her life, simply because people want to relitigate 1240 and the Supreme Court ruling. It doesn't make sense to me.
It doesn't, but we know that the teachers union is behind this, right? I mean, do you suspect that when it comes to the censure, they played a role?
I don't know because I wasn't out there. I think it had more to do with some of the, you know, the activists, so the Paramount Duty people, you know, some of the party activists that, you know, never really liked me. you know, and I think they just kind of rabble-roused and got it done. I don't know who was on that committee, to be honest with you. I didn't even know about it, as I said, until, you know, yesterday.
Well, what's interesting about this is you're a Democrat. You caucus with the Democrats. You've got a D next to your name, even though, you know, you're pretty open about this. You're more of a centrist, independent Democrat. But when you get hit by the party with a censure, what does that tell you about, you know, whether or not you're welcome?
Yeah, you know, it does make you feel bad, I'll be honest with you. And, you know, we're supposed to be a Big Ten party, you know, so, you know, if President Obama could be for charters, why can't I and still be part of the party and not get censured? So, you know, it doesn't make you feel great. You know, it's just the way that things are these days in politics. And, you know, it all starts with the media, too. This is something that's really kind of a bigger issue. Forget about me and forget about the censure. I think everybody knows, whether you're on the left or the right, that this era of people just being reactionary, they see a headline from a biased news organization like The Stranger, for example, right? Mm-hmm. So they see an article that's maybe not totally accurate, but it feeds the narrative that they like. So guy's a terrible person. Guy's all about charter schools, which I'm not. You know, it's not my number one issue. But it feeds into their narrative. So then they take that and they post it online. They get whipped up into a frenzy. They go to a meeting. They pass a resolution or a censure. People on both sides really in our democracy need to take a better care of not flying off the handle. Like, find out what it is you're talking about before you pass a judgment. You know, and I think that's really hurting our democracy and our civics.
I 100% agree.
Example of it.
Yeah, no, you're 100% correct. I'm glad you're fighting at least for some sort of fairness as it comes to charter schools. We've been talking with Senator Guy Palumbo, Democrat from Maltby. Senator, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason. I appreciate it.
Of course. It's the Jason Rancher. Coming up next, Ben Shapiro.